course, in the common political language of the world, such questioning is conducted by people. But more important than that is God's questioning. This is more important in the Islamic Republic. Of course, people's questioning is important as well, and this is a pillar of religious democracy.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Having a sense of responsibility towards the people is one of the pillars of the Islamic Republic and democracy. But much more important than this is having a sense of responsibility before God. O God, bestow your mercy on me when my reasoning fails before you, when I cannot find my tongue to give you answers, and when my mind makes a mistake when you ask me a question. Things are like this on Judgment Day. They will question us, but we will have no answers. We might have prepared some arguments and we express them, but they are rejected. Then we notice that our reasoning is not correct. If they ask us, why did you do this? Why did you not do that? We might have something to say and we express it, but it will be rejected. O God, bestow your mercy on me when my reasoning fails before you. When I cannot find my tongue to give you answers, and when my mind makes a mistake. When you ask me a question, this is in the holy supplication of Abu Hamza al-Thumali. Things are like this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Economic divide.
The French president came out on top in the recent presidential elections, edging out his main rival, Marine Le Pen. But what about the French economy? Is it doing well? Well, some economic numbers indicate that it is, but not all is well with France when it comes to the economy. 5 years of France under Macron, the topic of this edition of Economic Divide. Coming up in today's program, the French presidential elections, Macron beat Le Pen 29.5% to 23.5%. However, the participation rate was the lowest since 2002. Voters complained of a lack of new political ideas and few solutions to their problems. Then, 5 years of Macron, his economic performance is touted as being good, 7% GDP growth. But when you take a look at things like public debt, deficit, or loss of manufacturing jobs, things don't look that rosy. The rebound to be only temporary, called the COVID bounce back. And also, we will look at inequality in France and the Great Divide, deep fractures between the places where people are doing well, led by the city centers and tourist areas, but small towns and rural areas, as well as poor suburbs, they are not doing well.
France held the first round of its presidential election. Two candidates emerged victorious, Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen. They held the final election round on April 24th, but one particular issue dominated the election, the state of the French economy.
During Macron's first term in office, the French economy had lots of ups and downs. In 2021, France's GDP grew by 7%, but that high figure represents the rebound the French economy enjoyed after a historic negative 8% dip because of COVID-19 pandemic and the restrictions. His government managed to push France's stubbornly high unemployment rate to the lowest level since the start of the 2008 global financial crisis. Youth unemployment also came down during his presidency, but these gains were offset by rising prices, which were partly blamed on the crisis in Ukraine. France's inflation rate currently stands at 5.1%. That is lower than many of its neighbors, but a hike in energy bills has left many voters frustrated. That has forced the government to introduce measures like 100-euro handouts for 38 million people and a cap on gas and electricity prices. France also put together a more than 25 billion euro package of measures to soften the blow of an energy price-fueled inflation spike. Macron's rivals are capitalizing on voters' frustration with dwindling purchasing power. France's foreign debt is also exceptionally high. The country's foreign trade deficit surged another 7.3 billion euros in 2020 to reach 65.2 billion euros. That was due to Macron's policy to stabilize the economy at the start of the pandemic at whatever cost.
The French presidential election was forecast to be a tight race between the incumbent Macron and the Socialist Party candidate Marine Le Pen, but it turned out that it wasn't that close. But economically speaking, are the French really happy with Macron during the first 5 years of his presidency? Let's see what people had to say about this online. Our first post, it's "The Economy Stupid: France's Emmanuel Macron and Marine Le Pen Face Off, the Tough Truths of Democracy or the Easy Lies Autocracy." Number one issue, rising price of gas and food, world-changing crises, be damned. We face the same dynamic, indeed. Okay, moving on to our next post. And sure enough, the effect is already taking place, reaffirmed by Bloomberg. France's economy is slowing more than previously expected as industry suffers from soaring energy costs and worsening supply constraints following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Well, this viewer has said France's economy has bounced back strongly from the pandemic. Will it be Macron's strongest cards heading into the election on Sunday? Well, here she has referred to this entry as the basis of her claim. Macron banks on booming economy. The French economy has bounced back strongly from the pandemic, bolstering President Macron's bid for re-election. But some voters feel left behind. So even this entry actually acknowledges not all French are happy. Okay, those were some of the posts. Joining us for this segment of the Q&A is Sarah Guira. She's a journalist with Orient 21 who joins us from Paris. Sarah Guira, welcome. So our focus is 5 years of Macron. Some say Macron has done well. Others may disagree. I'd like to find out what you think. For example, attractiveness to business, its competitiveness, performance on growth. It seems like it's all coming up roses for Macron, but how close to reality is that campaign pitch in terms of what Macron has said?
Well, in a way, we can say that these statements are real, or at least they are, for a group of people, like for the wealthiest people, actually, the wealthiest part of the French population. Actually, we can summarize these 5 years of Emmanuel Macron saying that the wealthiest people became richer and the poorest become poorer. And that's why actually Emmanuel Macron has been nicknamed in France by the president of the rich people. So he, for example, like he made many things. We can say that the purchasing power, for example, of the 10% of the richest people grew by 22% in beginning 2022, like after the pandemic. Whether the 10% poorest people, their purchasing power only grew by 6.5%.
All right, let's bring in Sylvain Mercadier, French journalist and a political analyst who also joins us from Paris. Sylvain Mercadier, welcome. When you take a look at what people are saying on the streets, they're not happy about job security and also the quality of the jobs. They're saying that it's on the wane. One of the protesters that came out on the streets saying that, you know, we have to work two jobs and we still can't make ends meet. That obviously is a sign of inequality. So on that note, the wealthiest grew wealthier, but business investment actually has remained elusive. Does the government even realize that there's an inequality problem there in France?
Yeah, well, there clearly needs to be a structural modification of the French system, the economic system, its finance system. But, like, unfortunately, when you look at Macron's policies, it's his philosophy in terms of, like, government management. There is not going to be such a change of paradigm, let's say. This structural modification would require massive investments on a social level, the end of a neoliberal system governing the economy, and like basically the main problem is that like the French economy and like neoliberal economy in general is a prisoner of a system where it needs to please stakeholders, investors, and totally neglects the issues of inequalities.
It's time now for our InfoNews section of the program, focusing on economic news that we deemed to have some importance. Like our first pick, India's Central Bank pivots focus from growth to fighting inflation as prices rise. The Reserve Bank of India has stated that in the sequence of priorities that they have now put inflation before growth. Well, it also stated that inflation is going to continue to trend higher, and it will remain above the RBI's 2% to 6% target over the next 12 months. So in a sense, this is a developing story. Well, since we're on inflation, let's take a look at the inflation rate in the U.S. It is soaring at its fastest pace in over four decades. Consumer prices have actually risen 8.5% over the past 12 months. President Joe Biden has said that the climbing energy prices stemming from the war in Ukraine were the cause of 70% of the U.S. inflation. So the decision to be involved in that war is costing American consumers and Main Street, especially in the U.S. And looking at the U.S. economy even further, it was more bad news in this case for some banking institutions, such as J.P. Morgan, whose profits dropped 42% in the first quarter. Meanwhile, you have Wells Fargo's profits have declined 21% in the first quarter. Now, the case of J.P. Morgan has stated that the Ukraine conflict was one of the reasons, no surprise there, behind its losses. So another consequence of the war in Ukraine. And finally, moving on to the ECB, it has the European Central Bank. It confirms the end of its bond buying program for the third quarter. As inflation surges, bond buying is very similar to QE, quantitative easing, short for printing money. Now, the ECB faces a dilemma with inflation hitting a record high of 7.5% in March, while the economic growth outlook weakens due to the war in Ukraine. Again, no surprise there.
You're listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to our in-depth section. In this section, we will look at how Macron has done in the past years, the past 5 years, that is, and whether he has lived up to his promises or not. It was back in 2017 when Macron came into power. And just as any president coming into power, he promised to do many things, of which we're going to name that. Now, he was a former Rothschild banker, basically looking at these as being the pledges that stood out from the rest of it. For example, he pledged to cut taxes. At the same time, he also pledged to cut spending, which obviously is very big for France in terms of his debt. Also to streamline public services, which is another promise that he made. And then this one, to reform the pension system, something that is very controversial there in France. Now, in terms of cutting the taxes, let's pay a little bit of attention to that, because that requires obviously some focus here. The proposed tax cuts that Macron actually introduced were for the rich. And the goal was obviously savings to increase growth in jobs in terms of the investment. He dropped the tax rate on firms from 33.3% down to 25%. Now, 2 years after he introduced it, there was no conclusive evidence for that growth in jobs in terms of the reinvestment, I should say. And that's something that Macron failed in doing based on the decision that he made. He sold the reform on promises that it would steer savings into financing companies with the aim of benefiting growth and jobs. And as I mentioned, it has not yielded the desired results. Actually, the wealthiest French individuals didn't choose to invest in the real economy. At the same time, their purchasing power jumped over the past 5 years. So, in other words, the rich got richer. Now, to public debt and also to spending. That definitely has not happened. France has long struggled with high levels of public debt, and the pandemic has naturally made the situation worse. Its public debt ratio stood at around 115% for the year 2020. It's almost the same for the year 2021 at 115.83%. And moving on to 2022, projection in a sense is 113.45%, so not much. And when it comes to spending, well, this is where you can see the weakness in France's economic input versus output. You have at this point for the year 2020, the revenues coming in at 1.210 trillion euro, but yet spending stood at 1.493, so you went into negative territory. And then again, revenues for the year 2021, 1.273, and then you have spending at 1.493. There's a difference there. So that means that's in negative territory. These GDP growths obviously doesn't reflect well when you're spending more than you're making. Now, France's economy is slowing more than previously expected as the industry is suffering from soaring energy costs and also worsening supply constraints. And that's the result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The France GDP growth, this is the dip in the year 2020 from the pandemic at 7.99%. So that's quite a bit of a dip. And then you get the bounce back that came in at the year on the year 2021, which came in at 7%. And now that we're in the year 2022, the GDP growth actually falling back and then tapering off throughout the next few years, which is based on a projection, 1.82%, 1.49%. Not much of a GDP growth when you consider the fact that France is touted as being the Eurozone's second biggest economy. Now, when it comes to France's economy, it is actually slowing more than previously expected as the industry is suffering from soaring energy costs and worsening supply constraints. This is a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and this pretty much shows how that is happening. The ban on France, the Bank of France, that is, now expects growth to be only 0.25% of the first quarter. That is half the rate that it forecast in March, and that's a sharp drop from the 0.7% that was recorded in the final months of 2021 when France was Europe's standout performer in rebounding from the pandemic, something that I pointed out to before. Let's get some analysis into the picture. Sylvain Mercadier, French journalist, political analyst, joins us from Paris. Sylvain Mercadier, welcome back. So, 5 years of Macron, break that down for us in terms of his performance, things like growth, obviously, and then employment or purchasing power from consumers. Supposedly, it's all coming up roses, but how close to reality is that? At least Macron thinks that he's doing well.
Like France's competitiveness is not that good, actually. In Europe, for example, France lags behind Germany and in England on just on exports, like which is a key element of the economy. France's export profits has been 45 billion this year, compared to England, who has like greatly suffered from the Brexit, England is at 71 billion, while Germany is at 133 billion.
All right. Well, let's bring back Sarah Guerra, who's a journalist with Orient 21, and see what she thinks about this. Sarah Guerra, so we want to take a look at Macron's numbers. In some respects, Macron, at least in his perspective, seems to think that he's doing well. But some are saying that, well, it's not that flattering, especially when the GDP growth is touted to have bounced back, but it had come down to negative 8%. Also, we're looking at that rebound with other numbers in terms of, let's say, employment, saying that that's also, or unemployment, that that's also decreased. But then you take a look at the debt, that has increased. So it depends on how one gauges the numbers, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It depends on how one can read the numbers. Even like, for example, you talked about unemployment. There was this reform, actually, like 1 year ago, the reform of the unemployment insurance. And this reform makes it more difficult, especially for the more precarious people, not to find jobs, but to benefit from the government aids for unemployees. So,
after winning office in May of 2017, Macron quickly set out to trim France's social welfare spending. That summer, his government chose cuts that targeted low-income earners. They included a €5 a month cut to personalized housing aid and a massive reduction of subsidized employment contracts. He also introduced other measures, such as ending the wealth tax and imposing a 30% flat tax on capital gains. Macron's 2017 campaign platform had planned for some €25 billion in savings. €15 billion of those savings were in the healthcare sector, but raising the carbon tax on fuel a few months later was the last straw for some in France. The reforms prompted violent anti-government yellow vest protests in late 2018. At first, France's leadership downplayed the movement, but it could no longer be ignored after a few weeks. The movement claimed that a disproportionate burden of taxation in France was falling on the working and middle class. About 3 million people participated in the yellow vest movement. Apart from the yellow vest movement, many French are not satisfied with their jobs. In 2020, 3.3 million people in France held low security jobs, some 12.4% of the total employment. Many of the openings created have been low value added commercial service jobs.
When it comes to the French presidential elections, there is one issue that, like no other, has to be dealt with, and fast. And that is inflation. No honeymoon period for whoever is in office, whether it's the incumbent Macron or his contender, Marine Le Pen. And here's why. When it comes to inflation, France was no exception. French inflation rose more than expected in March to hit a record high. Consumer prices rose 1.6% in March for a 12-month inflation figure of 5.1%, up from 4.2% in February. French shopkeepers have also needed to increase the price of fish, for example, because of the impact of fuel prices on the fishing industry. The record inflation is bad news for Macron to secure a second term. Inflation impacts the consumer's purchasing power, a facet that is not unique to only France. But how has Macron been able to prevent the situation from getting worse than it is now? Lower than other countries in the Eurozone. First, it has done what other European countries have done, and that is caps on gas and power price increases. But why is the French inflation lower, coming in at 5.1%? That is because of the government spending to soften the blow of inflation. The caps are part of a package worth more than €25 billion or $28 billion. It also includes a fuel price rebate of 15 cents a liter and one-off payouts of government cash to people on low incomes. This does it for my segment. Let me know how I'm doing. Your questions and comments are very important to us.
Macron versus Le Pen. Political analysts say the French vote with their heart in the round one, then they vote with their head in round two. Well, the true story of France's economic system is you can't fix the problem by throwing money at it. That is what the French president did to fight the pandemic. Now, in the meantime, inequality has soared in France. The two tests is how Macron or Le Pen, whoever is picked, will deal with inflation and bottleneck issues especially due to the Ukraine crisis. That is it for this edition of the program. It was great having you with us. Any questions, comments, or critiques, please do send them to us. Contact information is on your screens now. From Mikhail Tahoe, it's goodbye. Until next time.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Iran's envoy to the United Nations, Majid Takht-Ravanchi, speaking at the UN Security Council session on Afghanistan recently, said Tehran had done all in its power to support refugees from Afghanistan over the past four decades, despite harsh sanctions. We now present you an article written by Sayed Zafar Mahdi, a Tehran-based journalist, editor, blogger, and author, under the heading, Rabble Rousers Sowing Seeds of Discord Between Iran and Afghanistan. In today's interconnected world, everything is a just a click away, including violent public disturbances. In recent days, social media has been inundated with fake videos purportedly showing the mistreatment of Afghan refugees in Iran. The unverified videos have circulated at a dizzying pace, fueled anger and sparked some protests by unknown men in the neighboring country, including attacks on Iran's diplomatic missions in Kabul and in Herat in Afghanistan. Afghan refugees always were warmly welcomed in Iran since the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Thus, it is a sheer lie to suggest that Afghan refugees in Iran are in any manner exploited or terrorized by the people or by the government. Some of the posts doing rounds on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram these days smell of foul play, making it emphatically clear that there is method to this madness. It's nothing new or astonishing, though. A tiny minority of troublemongers with divisive agendas have always been hell-bent on manufacturing crises between the two brotherly nations of Iran and Afghanistan. Most of the time, the flames have been fanned by forces inimical to peace and to stability in the region. The latest row was triggered by an incident at the highly revered Imam Reza's holy shrine in the northeastern Iranian city of Mashhad on 5th of April, when a man in his early 20s stabbed three clerics. One of them has attained martyrdom instantly, another succumbed to his fatal wounds later on in a hospital. The third person has survived. The assailant's identity was not disclosed by the authorities in the city of Mashhad, but local media identified him as Abdul Latif Moradi, an Afghan national who had illegally crossed into Iran from Pakistan last year. Moradi was immediately taken into police custody. The two martyred individuals included Mohammad Aslani, a senior cleric who was volunteering with the shrine in the holy month of Ramadan, and Mohammad Sadiq Darai, a 26-year-old cleric who breathed his last the day his national identity card was expiring. Both have left behind their loved ones, including small children. The graphic videos of the incident, shared widely on social media sites, showed the victims lying in a pool of blood in the main courtyard of the shrine, which is a popular pilgrimage site in the Islamic Republic of Iran. While the gory incident drew widespread condemnation, the reaction of officials in Iran was extremely measured, for fear of backlash against the Afghan refugee community living in the country. No threats were issued and no refugees were deported, unlike what you hear in some foreign media outlets. In turn, a senior government official in the city of Mashhad warned against playing into the hands of the enemy. Afghan scholars based in Iran also unequivocally condemned the gruesome incident, saying the assailant, inspired by the Takfiri thought, did not belong to them. Senior Afghan politicians such as former chief executive Dr. Abdullah Abdullah and a spokesman for the Taliban, Zabihullah Mujahid, also condemned the cowardly attack. But the mischief mongers behind the incident were already ready with their murky games to vitiate the atmosphere and stoke tensions and discord between the two neighboring countries. The soil on the graves of the two victims in the city of Mashhad was still wet when a flurry of videos took social media sites by storm, purportedly showing Afghan refugees being ill-treated in Iran. One of the videos showed a group of unruly men bashing two young boys, with police trying to intervene. The Twitterati alleged that it was Iranian men beating Afghan refugees without any evidence. Another video showed a man filming a young Afghan boy whilst harassing him, a horrible prank indeed. It's unclear where the video was shot, but what's clear is the motivation behind its leak now. One post on Twitter alleged that Iranian forces were harshly beating Afghan refugees and forcing them to leave the country. On analysing the video carefully, it appears that the video has not been shot in Iran, and the uniform worn by the assailants does not belong to Iran's police force. The unverified video sparked angry protests in Afghanistan, with a group of unknown men attacking Iran's embassy in the city of Kabul and Iran's consulate building in the western Afghan city of Herat. They hurled stones and smashed security cameras at Iran's embassy in Kabul. In the city of Herat, they tried to barge inside the consulate building, but the bid was thwarted by consulate guards. In contrast, Iranian officials refused to join the circus, calling on the rulers in Kabul to ensure the security of Iran's diplomatic mission in the war-ravaged country and uphold the rich history of brotherly relations between Tehran and Kabul. In a beautiful gesture, Iranian President Dr. Ebrahim Raisi joined a group of Afghan students in Tehran for iftar ceremony, sending a clear message to troublemakers that their bid to pit Iranians and Afghans against each other was not going to work. Iran's special envoy for Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Qomi, warned against attempts to sow discord between Iranians and Afghans and affirmed that foreign actors were indeed behind the protests. Iran has for the past four decades played host to one of the largest and most protracted refugee situations in the world. Iran is home to some 4 million Afghan documented and undocumented Afghan refugees, 1 million of whom fled their home country after the Taliban's sweeping takeover and the botched exit of the U.S. military forces from Afghanistan last August. According to aid agencies, around 4,000 to 5,000 Afghan refugees have been streaming into Iran each day in recent months through informal border crossings, and they have been embraced with open arms despite Iran's own limited capacity due to crippling U.S. sanctions. Iran's assistance to the war-weary Afghan refugees has been largely without any international aid at a time when rich Western countries have erected walls to prevent the entry of Afghan refugees into their countries. From prioritizing the vaccination of Afghan refugees to providing them with equal educational opportunities, Iran's approach to the Afghan refugee community has been marked by compassion and by humanity. Top United Nations officials have acknowledged the role played by Iran in alleviating the suffering of Afghan refugees, whilst urging the world to share the burden. The Norwegian Refugee Council, an independent humanitarian organization, provided assistance to refugees across the world, also commended Iran for welcoming with an open arm and hosting millions of displaced Afghans for the past four decades. In a statement recently, the Norwegian Refugee Council called on the international community to step up support for Iran and urge rich nations to ramp up aid and keep their borders open to people fleeing conflict. While Iran, which shares a 572-mile border with Afghanistan, has, in line with its refugee policy, provided necessary assistance to Afghan refugees. But Iran has also continued to remind the international community of its responsibilities towards the people displaced by the 20-year failed military U.S. adventure in Afghanistan. During a recent phone conversation with the Taliban's acting foreign minister, Amir Khan Mottaqi, the Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian said, "Millions of Afghan brothers and sisters living in Iran for the past 40 years have always been provided with necessary services." The top Iranian diplomat Amir Abdullahian touched on a wave of malicious, calculated and false propaganda on some social networks, saying it is spread by those enemies and opponents of good relations between Iran and Afghanistan. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said, The Islamic Republic of Iran has a positive and constructive view of Afghanistan. He added, Iran's exchange of delegations for cooperation between the two countries, sending humanitarian aid, and keeping its mission active in providing services to the people of Afghanistan has been within this framework. Iran's envoy to the United Nations, Majid Takht-Ravanchi, speaking at a UN Security Council session on Afghanistan on 27th of January this year, asserted that Tehran had done all in its power to support the Afghan refugees over the past four decades, despite harsh sanctions. Takht-Ravanchi said the financial constraints due to US sanctions were impeding Iran's efforts to assist incoming refugees. According to estimates, more than 96% of Afghan refugees live in Iranian cities, towns and villages alongside their Iranian host communities, while 4% put up in more than a dozen settlements managed by the Interior Ministry in collaboration with the United Nations Refugee Agency. While troublemongers are busy fomenting trouble, Iran continues to do whatever it can to support the Afghan refugee community, as it has done for the past four decades. There definitely are issues, but it is not the way they want you to believe.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Recent deadly attacks in Afghanistan have left Afghan families grieving. Some have lost their parents and some their children. Here we are meeting the family of Shahid Melad, who was killed in Tuesday's school bombing in Kabul. Melad's mother can't speak as she is in a flood of tears, mourning the loss of her young son. But his disabled father managed to speak with great sorrow.
Melad was a very diligent boy. It was his last year at school. He was preparing himself to enter university. He used to tell me that he was going to become a doctor and make a living so that his father doesn't have to work. He wished to serve his family and society, but unfortunately they took him from us.
In another alley in Hazara neighborhood, another family is mourning the death of a father. After the attack on the school students, Mir Hussein went to bring his son home, but he himself fell victim to the second explosion.
My brother was on the roof when he heard a bomb explosion at the school. He quickly went to school to find his son Mahdi. He was searching around when the second explosion occurred. He was injured in the attack, but later at the hospital, we lost him forever.
Mahdi has survived the attack, but he is struggling with the shock of the attack and the pain of losing his father. Likewise, in the west of Kabul, there are many families whose beloved ones are either killed or wounded. They feel despaired and can't hold back their tears. It remains to be seen if the time can heal their wounds.
These days, Afghan families want peace and security. People here say they're terrified of repeated blind terror attacks. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A big rally was held in the besieged Gaza Strip to support Al-Quds in the face of rising Israeli aggression against the holy city. Thousands of people from all walks of life came out to express their adherence to resistance as the best way to defend Al-Quds against Israeli attacks. Tensions have been on the rise in recent days as extremist Israeli settlers, backed by Israeli regime forces, desecrated the city's Al-Aqsa Mosque. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and slammed the silence of Arab countries towards the Israeli crimes. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas, which organized the Friday rally, warned the Israeli regime against violations in Al-Quds.
We will not leave Al-Quds as a prey for the Zionist enemy, and our people are united today in defending Al-Quds. The Palestinian resistance is very strong and will defend Al-Quds against Zionist attacks. Today's rally and the masses here are sending a strong message to the Zionist enemy. If these Zionist attacks against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque don't come to an end, our people will explode in the face of the Zionist entity.
Since the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan, the Israeli forces and illegal settlers have been trying to prevent Palestinians from gathering and performing their religious duties at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state.
We are here today to show our solidarity and support for Al-Quds in the face of Zionist aggressions. All Palestinian resistance groups are here to send a message of unity. We will spare no effort to protect Al-Quds, and we call on all Arabs and Muslims to support the resistance and help us to protect Al-Quds and the Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians have expressed their willingness to sacrifice their lives for the sake of liberating Al-Quds.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians in Al-Quds and turned a blind eye to Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Islam's holy book, the Quran, is the theme of this expo. Held every year in the fasting month of Ramadan, the International Quran Exhibition opened its doors after 2 years of hiatus, driven by the coronavirus pandemic. Now, the 29th edition of the event has brought here exhibitors from Iran and other Muslim countries to present their religious products. While the expo displays exquisite copies of the Quran, it also gives a chance to IT firms to showcase online versions of the Holy Book, among other religious apps and software. The art section is one of the popular parts of the event. It features paintings, calligraphy works, and conceptual artworks, all themed with the Quran. The holy month of Ramadan is believed to be the month when the holy book of Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad some 14 centuries ago. That's why this exhibition is held during the holy month, which is also referred to as the month of Quran.
Every Muslim family has a copy of the Quran in their houses to read its verses and ponder its divine messages as many times as possible during the year, and especially in Ramadan, as the month of the Quran's revelation to the Prophet. Now, one of the major goals of this expo is to promote the instructions of the Divine Book, especially among the younger generation. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Braving the scorching heat while fasting, protesters took to the streets after Friday prayers across Pakistan to voice solidarity with Palestinians as tension continued to simmer in the occupied Al-Quds, where Israeli forces once again attacked Palestinian worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Protesters here are outraged over what they call the double standards of the international community and the way they view Ukraine compared to Palestine.
Double standards is the biggest issue with international community. East Timor, South Sudan, Kashmir, Palestine, you name it. When Muslims are victims, they will always turn their backs on us. Therefore, I think it's about time to put an end to this collective behavior against Muslims on international stage.
Actually, we are being a Muslim, Al-Aqsa, the Muslims over there are brothers and sisters. If they're in pain, we are feeling the same pain in our body. The whole Muslim Ummah is like a one body. If one part feels is in pain, the whole body feels the pain. So we are feeling that pain, and we are gathered here to tell the world that they are not alone. We are with them.
Speakers at the rally stressed upon the need of unity among the Muslim world.
People are who are gathered over here because of, as you know, the situation which is going on in Palestine. Israelis are continuously terrorizing or they're attacking the innocent people of Palestine. That's why we are gathering in the protest to show their solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Again, you know, the Jews, army and the military, paramilitary forces, they are not letting the Muslims over there freely praying and offering their rituals of the Ramadan. And everybody knows This is the holiest month of Ramadan, and this is very sacred to the Muslim.
The Israeli aggression against Palestinians has once again escalated during the fasting month of Ramadan. Scores of Palestinians have been injured by the Israeli forces at the Al-Aqsa Mosque over the past few days. Mohammed Touri, Karachi.
Amid ongoing violence in Palestine, hundreds of London protesters mobbed outside Israel's embassy to condemn the regime's ongoing onslaught. The Islamic holy site in the occupied capital, Jerusalem, Al-Quds, has been targeted with daily raids by not just regime forces, but also Zionist fanatics who seek to desecrate Islam's second holiest site during Ramadan, the holiest month for Muslims.
I struggle to comprehend how human beings can do this to others. It's occupation, but for the numbers of people that are happy to use their hate to hit and kill people, the anger that I feel and the sadness and the heartache for the Palestinians, it's difficult.
The unrest also sparked hostilities between Gaza-based Palestinian resistance fighters and Israeli regime forces as the two sides exchanged fire early on Thursday. The lack of mainstream media attention, despite the shocking footage which has emerged, has equally infuriated many onlookers.
It's not just me. Every Palestinian have been hit with the fact that international law is very selective. The application of international law depends on the interests of these countries. And, you know, the major powers insist to keep putting Israel above the law, to keep shielding Israel from international scrutiny and international sanctions. And if this does anything, it actually exposes that the world is not serious about its own rules and laws.
This isn't the first time that the Israeli regime has conducted acts of aggression against Muslims during the holy month of Ramadan in occupied Palestine. However, global awareness of Israel's crimes is at an all-time high, and with future protest action planned over the next days and weeks here in London, the global reaction to what's been going on is far from over. Robert Carter, London.
Whispers with God on a night that's believed by Muslims to be a time when their wishes are fulfilled. It's called Laylatul Ghadr, or the Night of Destiny. Muslims observe the occasion every year in the month of Ramadan, when they congregate at religious sites to pray and make wishes. To Iranians, no place is better than the shrine of the 8th Shia Imam Reza in the city of Mashhad to keep vigil on the occasion.
Words cannot describe my feelings tonight. It's a night of destiny when God has promised to listen to our prayers. It's a night which the Quran says is better than 1,000 months. I'm so happy to be in Imam Reza's shrine on this divine night.
After 2 years, we once again can visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, our beloved Imam, and that on the night of destiny. I wish that God will eradicate the coronavirus once and for all, for us to be able to live peacefully and visit our holy sites.
Islamic scriptures say Laylatul Qadr marks the night when the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. The Quran says on this night, angels descend on earth to listen to the prayers of worshippers.
We believe that on the night of destiny, angels come to earth upon God's order. The Quran says in its verses that the book was revealed to the Prophet on this night, and the angels will stay on earth till dawn. That's why we never miss out on this holy night and come here to pray.
No exact date is provided for the Night of Destiny, but all Islamic references are unanimous that the Quran was revealed to the Prophet on one of three different dates, the 19th, the 21st, or the 23rd night of the holy month of Ramadan.
It's the first time after more than 2 years that the Night of Destiny is marked without serious concerns over the coronavirus. And this has attracted this huge number of pilgrims to the shrine of Imam Reza to once again mark Laylatul Qadr en masse and at the same time reunite with their 8th Imam after 2 years. Yusuf Jalali from the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad.
violence, oppression, and desecration of holy sites. Just more of the Ramadan reminders that Palestinians continue to live under occupation and suffer daily injustices. More than ever, international solidarity, especially in an age of social media, is important. With the atrocities being committed against Palestinians, raising awareness and exhibiting support is more crucial than before. This year's Fly the Flag for Palestine campaign is giving millions across the world the opportunity to show solidarity by displaying a Palestinian flag in person or online.
If we are not able to stand up at this hour of need and be supportive to those Palestinians by holding a flag on our car, on our shops, on our homes, then what are we good for? And when are we going to do this? And I think what I have seen, ordinary people responding so fantastically.
In the lead up to the annual Al-Quds rally in the British capital, the global support for the campaign is in full swing. Organizers are encouraging participation in this year's event, and taking part could not be more simple. First of all, please post your image or your footage online, encourage a few friends to do the same, and of course, use the hashtag. As the global solidarity movement grows, so does the opposition, a fact not lost on pro-Palestine campaigners.
We got ministers coming and saying, they're going to refer us to the police for saying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. It's outrageous. These are the same people that actually articulate that freedom of speech is absolute, and they go on and on. What's wrong with any part of the world to be free? What's wrong with asking people to be free?
So organizers are urging you to do your part. Lift your voice in solidarity and fly the flag for Palestine. Amina Taylor, London.
Yemen Civil Aviation and Meteorology Authority announced that the first commercial flight to Sana'a International Airport will start next Sunday from and to Jordan. Observers say the UN brokered agreement said there will be two flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan, and allowing one flight only is not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Announcing the start of one flight per week to Jordan is not enough and confirms there are no sincere intentions by the Saudi-led coalition to abide by the declared UN truce. There must be a full opening of Sana'a Airport and the port of Hodeidah because the humanitarian situation cannot tolerate more restrictions.
The Ministry of Health says thousands of patients, including children, are in dire need to travel abroad for treatment. Therefore, the United Nations should fulfill its duty and remove any restrictions on the two-weekly flights.
Yemeni patients suffer greatly due to the closure of Sana'a's international airport because they need to travel abroad for treatment. There are 30,000 registered patients in the higher medical committee, including children suffering from congenital anomalies and cancer. We demand the United Nations and the UN envoy open Sana'a's airport permanently and not for one or two flights per week, as it's not enough to help the humanitarian situation.
Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen on March 2015 and imposed a closure on Sana'a International Airport. This closure has led to the death of thousands of patients, including children, especially amid the collapse of the healthcare system in the country due to the years-long Saudi war and the blockade.
Yemenis received the news of resuming the flights of Sana'a International Airport with hopes to see further flights to other destinations around the world. They say opening Sana'a Airport will save the lives of thousands of Yemeni patients, including children, who are in danger amid the absence of essential healthcare services. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
For the first time since the onset of the COVID pandemic, hundreds of people of faith and none gathered in the shadow of North London's Finsbury Park Mosque to enjoy a breaking of the fast in a public setting. The iftar, backed by the local council and organized by Finsbury Park Mosque, Muslim Welfare House and British Muslim charity Islamic Relief, was an opportunity for the community to gather, celebrate and reflect.
It's good to show solidarity, Muslim, non-Muslim, Jews, Christian, all coming together to share a meal. This is very